वास्मि च वै वास्मि न जीवामि तं विना इति विद्यायदादेतं नैनं शरणन्ति ते.
First, I offer my humble obeisances and the dust of the lotus feet of my most worshipable Vishnu Gurudev, Nityananda Pravishta Om Vishnu Pada Stodara Siddhashi Srimad Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and the same unlimited obeisances and the dust of the lotus feet of my most worshipable Shiksha Gurudev, Om Vishnu Pada Stodara Siddhashi Srimad Srila Bhaktivedanta Narayan Goswami Maharaj, to all of our disciplic succession and all the assembled devotees. So, since Ojai is known as a town of advanced spiritual people and meditation and yoga, tonight we're going to be discussing the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is the main book of yoga in the world. And this chapter is called Yoga and Meditation. In the beginning, this yoga lesson is taught by Sri Krishna himself, who is described in the Vedas as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of all existence. So he must be the best teacher of the best yoga system. And he's teaching what is called renunciation is the same as yoga, or linking oneself with the Supreme. For no one can be a perfect yogi unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. So yoga, the word yoga means plus, God plus me. He's already plus and complete. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. And so many complete units emanate from him, like this phenomenal world. Although so many complete units emanate from him, still he remains the complete balance. He's not diminished in any way. Like the sun has been emanating heat and light for billions of years, and it hasn't gotten cold. It's still full. So what to speak of God, who is the source of innumerable suns. So he's teaching that what is the same as yoga, what is called renunciation is the same as yoga, or linking oneself with the Supreme. No one can become a yogi unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. Now, what is sense gratification? Perhaps this little story will shed some light. There was once a man, dutiful, who used to go to work. He's very regulated, normal, everyday American. And he would get his salary at the end of the week. And then he would go to the bank and deposit his money for savings for when he would become old. So week after week, year after year, he was doing this and felt very secure in his life because of that. Now he's getting old, time to retire, and he wants to withdraw his money now. So he goes to the bank and gives the lady his card with his ID number on it. And she says, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, I can't give you any money." "Why?" "Because all these years, you've been putting your money in the wrong bank account. You've been giving me the wrong number." So he goes, "In the wrong? In the wrong? In the wrong?" And he has a heart attack and dies. So we're putting our energy, sense gratification means putting our energy in the wrong place, in dead matter. Like putting the food in the pocket, or when I put my clothes in the washing machine, I think that I'm swirling around and now I'm being heated up in the dryer. This is called identification with the senses. And what is the quality of sense gratification in this world? This gratifying the coverings of the soul's real eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and everything else. There is another story that might illustrate this. There was a wife, very chaste, faithful wife, and she had a husband who wasn't so chaste and faithful. In fact, he was attached to a prostitute, and he was especially attached to a particular famous prostitute, very beautiful but extremely expensive. So he couldn't even go. So when the wife understood this, she was so chaste and faithful that she didn't become jealous or angry, but rather she went to that prostitute's house and began to work for her. And when the prostitute saw that, she didn't tell the prostitute, she just started working in her area or garden, something that belonged to her. And when the prostitute saw that and understood why she was doing that, she said, "Well, you don't realize how expensive I am." And she gave some exorbitant number. So then the wife, so dedicated to her husband's pleasure that she would do anything, finally she herself became a prostitute and made enough money. And she gave the husband the money. And he was such a rascal that instead of repenting by seeing what a wonderful wife he had, he just went off to this prostitute's house. So generally, in at least in Indian prostitution, the prostitute would serve some dinner to the man first. So this prostitute knew who this man was because she was now friends with the wife. So she gave him the same preparation in two different kinds of pots. One was a brass pot and one was a golden pot. So he said, "What is this?" She said, "Just taste it and tell me what you think." So he tasted the preparation, the foodstuffs from both the pots. And she said, "Well, what do you think?" So he said, "Well, it tastes exactly the same." So she said, "Yes, you're such a rascal that you think that sense gratification tastes different in me and your wife, whereas it's actually the same thing. Sense gratification, the gratification of the eyes, ears, nose, belly, anus, genitals, is exactly the same, or in other words, sex life in this situation, is exactly the same in the heavenly planets, in the human beings, and in the animals. So this is sense gratification." Then, so Krishna, God himself, is saying, no one can be a yogi or no one can link with the Supreme Consciousness and thus our own consciousness unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. Then he continues. A person is said to have attained yoga when, having renounced all material desires, he neither acts for sense gratification nor engages in fruitive activities. So what is a material desire? A material desire is to yearn for something that has nothing to do with myself and that renders the mind unsatisfied. If I have a material desire, then I feel unsatisfied, not because my desire has not been fulfilled, or not because my desire hasn't been completely fulfilled according to my wishes, but the source of the agitated mind, according to Krishna himself, God himself, is the desire itself. When the mind desires connection with its source, that is God himself, then even not having attained that ambition, but just desiring it, the mind becomes peaceful. Simply by desiring sense gratification, or anything material, something that has nothing to do with myself, I become dissatisfied at heart. Even if I attain the thing, because my desire is for that thing I've attained, I can't find satisfaction. the journey that the soul makes in this body shows that. The baby comes out of the womb and he's crying and the nurse is taking care of him and the baby has a desire for the mother's breast milk and the nurse thinks that he has some pain, so she gives him some bitter tasting medicine. First of all, the desires aren't even satisfied properly. Then he goes to school and he's embroiled in enviousness and quarreling, competition, getting his feelings hurt, trying to hurt the feelings of others when he's in school. And this goes on and on. Then he grows older. And then when he gets very old, his very own children want to put him in a home. And in some countries, they even have a feast and eat the old grandparents. And then at the time of death, everybody's surrounding him. And they can't see what's really happening to him. That at the point of death, the constables of death come and they rip him out of his body and put him in various kinds of hells. Just like now we're covered by this subtle body, we become covered by another subtle body, which is the proper apparel for undergoing different kinds of hellish situations according to my past material activities. If my mind is material, my desires are material, my activities are material, and inadvertently the nature of material activities is called jiva-jiva-sajivanam. One living entity is the food for another living entity. In order to walk from my house to the movie theater, I have to step on so many ants and other kinds of insects. I have to breathe so many different kinds of bacteria. And I have to eat other living entities as well. And the result is, as it says in the Bible, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Whatever I even unknowingly hurt anybody else, there's a law of nature or a law of God that I have to myself get hurt. Tit for tat. Or this is called the law of karma. This is the, if we take material desires to its next step. My mind is material, so my activity is material. Material activity means one living entity is the sustenance of another living entity. Then I hurt another living entity. And then there are laws. There are laws of nature and laws of God. I can see the law of man. Like if I cross at the red light instead of the green light, then there's a siren coming and the police are coming to give me a fine. Or if I park in the wrong place. Or if I hit somebody with my car. In India, they don't even wait for a law. The law is just spontaneous. About 50 guys come and just beat you to death.
Beat the living daylights out of you.
It's true.
So these are laws. So as there's laws of man, but man is imperfect, so the laws are imperfect, and sometimes you can get away. But there's no imperfection in the law of God. So therefore I'm always being punished. So these are the, if we take material desires to the next step. So then Krishna continues. And fruit of activities means same thing. I engage in activities to enjoy the fruits of those activities. And by the nature of this world, no one can engage in fruit of activities without hurting somebody else. Then in the next verse, Krishna continues. This is an overview of the sixth chapter. A man must elevate himself, since the crux of the matter is desires. A man must elevate himself, and desires come from the mind. A man must elevate himself by his own mind and not degrade himself, for the mind is the best friend of the conditioned soul and his greatest enemy as well. Everybody is looking for a friend and an enemy. But we don't know that they're both within us. The mind that's controlled is the best friend, and the mind that's not controlled is the greatest enemy. Control means my mind listens to me, the soul, or the soul driving the intelligence. And the uncontrolled mind means that the senses control the mind controls the intelligence. And then that intelligence, which is bewildered by being controlled by the mind, which is controlled by the wild senses, destroys the life of the soul. Now, let's paint a picture to illustrate that. Let me see if this picture is already in here.
The wild horses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's one picture.
I think it's in the front.
That our spiritual master...
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
There's one picture that our spiritual master requested the art department to do. And that is... That is, you have the picture of a chariot. And in front of the chariot, there are five horses. Then the horses are wild. They're not under the control of the driver. The horses are pulling the reins, not that the reins are controlling the horses. The horses are dragging the reins, and the reins are dragging the driver.
Here we go.
Okay. If you can see this little picture.
Each horse represents a sense.
Yeah.
But I hope I get the book back soon because I have to read the next verse. And the intelligence, the driver is being dragged by the reins, which is being dragged by the horses, and the passenger doesn't know what's going to happen to him. Just imagine if you're in a car, and usually the foot pedal works, the steering wheel works, the speed dial works, but now you're in the car and nothing works. Everything is working on its own, and you're just the helpless driver. And especially if you're going up a mountainside or anywhere, even in a street, it's very, very dangerous. So, as Krishna Bhamani said, each horse represents one of the five senses, that is, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the skin. And they engage us in hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and seeing. Now, the mind is supposed to control the senses. The mind is supposed to have a discrimination power of knowing what is right and what is wrong. But when the mind is controlled by the senses, the reins are controlled by the horses, then there's no control. It's wild and very dangerous. Then the intelligence is supposed to be able to control the mind. The mind accepts and rejects, and the intelligence has discrimination power. The mind accepts and rejects without any, when it's not controlled by the intelligence, it's just accepting and rejecting the same thing without any reason. I hate this person, I like this person. I hate this thing, I like this thing. And my mind is always changing and always flickering. And then the driver is the intelligence, the reins is the mind, and the horses is the senses. And the passenger is the soul inside the body. There are two, the analogy is given that there's two birds in a tree. One bird is the soul. The tree is the body, and the other bird, the friendly bird, is God himself sitting in the heart as the witness of all of our activities and the friend. The other bird, the tasting bird, is trying to taste the fruits of the tree. Sometimes the fruits taste bitter, and sometimes the fruits taste sweet. But actually, they're all bitter fruits. But we're calling one bitter, and we're calling one sweet. The body is, if we consider that the body is pus, blood, stool, urine, bones, and
flesh.
Then to taste this body, we can only mentally speculate that, okay, this part of it is good and this part of it is bad. It's only because this conglomerate of untasteful elements surrounds the soul and takes some form, like a glove takes the form of the hand, and so it looks like a hand, but it's not. That we think there's some life there, but it's not life. If we consider, as our spiritual master said, you can take it from the Vedas or you can take it from common affairs. What is this body made of? So we say sometimes the fruits are sweet and sometimes they're bitter, but always they're bitter. We're just, by mental speculation, saying this is good and this is bad. So the tasting bird is madly going after the fruits of the tree. And here it is. You see, the one bird is crazily going after the fruits, and you can see what it represents. The man is going after the woman. And then there's a friendly bird witnessing his activities and just saying, if you just turn to me and have a beautiful relationship with me, then you'll be happy. You'll be free from this conglomerate of untasteful elements. Now here it is. This is the process of sense gratification, fruit of activities, and tasting the fruits of this body. Sri Krishna, the Supreme Lord, says, when first there's attachment, attraction and attachment for sense objects, that is, I have senses. I have senses, eyes, and the eye goes towards a sense object, which is sight, something that is seen. So, can you see from there? We'll pass it around, but I need it back soon. So, from attachment to the objects of the senses, the boy sees the girl. From attachment to the objects of senses, then lust arises. And lust has a younger brother. And that younger brother is called anger. Anger always follows lust for the simple reason that lust is compared by God himself to a raging fire. And no matter how much we try to pacify the fire by giving it food or fuel, that fire becomes more and more raging. It's never pacified or satisfied. So lust is just like a fire, which is never satisfied. So first he sees the girl, then he becomes lusty, then he becomes attached, then he becomes angry because there's another man, then he becomes bewildered, loss of memory, loss of intelligence, and then he falls into the material whirlpool of transmigration, being thrown in the various species of life due to material desires. So, as Krishna says in the Gita, whatever the mind thinks of at the time of death, it attains that state without fail. Whatever the mind thinks of at the time of death, it attains that state without fail. For example, in the insect world, there's a wasp and a butterfly, or a moth. And the wasp goes to attack the moth. and he backs up the moth into a corner. And this is actual scientific fact. The moth, when he's in his corner, and he's completely petrified because he's seeing the imminent envelopment of the wasp, that he's going to be swallowed up in the next second. So he's petrified looking at the wasp, and what happens? In his next life, because he's thinking of the wasp at the time of death, he also becomes a wasp. Whatever one thinks of at the time of death, he attains that state without fail. He gets a certain set of senses. I know that sounds like a tongue twister, but it's really a fact. He gets a certain set of senses centered about the mind. Just like somebody who is attached to sex life. He likes to eat his own, to taste his own blood, because every drop of semina is worth 60 drops of blood. So he's thinking of these things at the time of death. So what might he become? He might become a camel, because the way a camel eats is that it has a long neck and it can go way up into the tree and take the leaves. It likes to eat thorny branches. This is also a biological scientific fact. It likes to eat thorny branches. Now, who would like to eat a thorny branch? The camel. Why? Because when he chews on the thorns, it cuts his tongue and it mixes with his blood, and he's enjoying the taste of his own blood.
Oh my God.
So in this way, one falls into the whirlpool of material existence. By contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment. From attachment, lust arrives. From lust, anger, because anger is the younger brother of lust, which is just like a fire and can never be satisfied. Therefore, anger comes, because the younger brother always follows the older brother. And then one becomes bewildered, his intelligence is bewildered, and he falls into the material whirlpool of the cycle of birth and death in different species. So, Krishna says, God says, a man must therefore elevate himself by his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the best friend and the greatest enemy as well. Now, as mentioned before, everyone is looking for a friend and an enemy, but we don't know that both the friend and the enemy is already in me, the mind. Otherwise, nobody's my friend and my enemy. Suppose a materialist would think that if somebody insults him, then that person is my enemy. But how does a devotee think? If somebody chastises him or criticizes him or insults him, he thinks, now why would that person do that? I'm trying to be a devotee. Oh, I know I have some impurity, and God himself, Krishna himself, is trying to correct me through the nature of this person. So he considers the person as his good friend. Okay. Then Krishna continues. Oh, is that what's happening? That's moving?
Yeah.
Okay. It didn't happen the other night.
Yeah. Well, things. Everything material deteriorates. Well, is there any difference between one way or another?
No. Turn it off.
Yeah, let's turn it off. We can
hear you.
Okay. That was probably my mind that was amplified there. Okay, so Krishna is continuing. For he who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. But for one who has failed to do so, his very mind is the greatest enemy. For one who has conquered the mind,
The soul is reached. He's in connection with his own soul. For he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, pleasure and pain is all the same. Because he doesn't see any significance, how is it that he can see happiness and distress as the same? It's obviously two different things. How can he take honor and dishonor as the same? It's obviously completely different things. Well, it's not different things. Because suppose we're having a dream, and in the dream I get a lot of money, or in the dream somebody is cutting my arms off, and then I wake up from the dream. What was the difference between getting money and getting the torture? There's no difference, because neither one of them is happening to me. It's all happening in my mind. So therefore, the mind is the enemy if it's not controlled. If my mind just takes me off, like in a dream. The person is just lying there in the bed. But the dream takes us to this place and that place and that place. Then we wake up and there's nothing there. So happiness and distress, he sees this as the same, because he sees them both as dream. Once I was in a car with Srila Gurudev, and we were going from Badger to Oakland about 8 years ago. And he said, oh, those 2 weeks that we had in Australia and the 2 weeks that we had in Badger went just like a moment, like a dream. It's like a moment. Hmm. I asked why. I said, you said the same thing back in Australia, that it was like a dream. He said, when you realize Krishna, then you'll understand that there's no reality here. That if we have material affection for anybody else, it's not real affection, it's illusion, it's like a dream. So I asked, how is that? So he said, well, would one Atma marry another Atma? So I said, okay, well, what about two God brothers then? They're not getting married. So he said, still, does one God brother really know who the other God brother is? No, he just knows the body. And therefore, even a male to male, female to female, affection is illusion until we have affection for Krishna. It's illusion because I have so-called affection for one person if they're pleasing to my senses, which are not me. And then I don't like somebody who's not pleasing to my senses, or what to speak of displeasing to my senses, which is also not me. And it's only displeasing to me by my mind's dictation, which is flickering. A devotee is a friend of everyone's. He doesn't see how that person likes him or not. He just sees how he likes that person, because that person is part of his Lord, who he loves.
So can't we love everyone by relating, by attempting to relate, seeing how we're all related eternally in a spiritual way?
We can attempt to love each other by attempting to relate.
Yeah.
So first, that's a very good point, because first it starts with gyan. Gyan means theoretical knowledge. That is, okay, you just insulted me. Am I going to say something back? Or am I going to force my mind to think that that person didn't say anything? They were just either forced by the modes of nature to say it, maybe because I said something bad to somebody else, or they're a great devotee and therefore Krishna himself is telling them to say it, so it's not them. Or maybe I just understood it the wrong way. Maybe they were saying something nice and I took it the wrong way. So intellectually, I force my mind, as Krishna will say later in this chapter, from whatever and wherever the mind may wander, due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. First intellectually, as you've said, And then when mercy comes down, then it will be called vigyan, or realized knowledge. An example is given by my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. Before he came to America in 1966 and started going around the world, he was reading about America when he was in India. And the book said, in America it snows. So he's telling all of his friends in India, oh, in America it snows. That was theoretical knowledge. Then he came to America in September, and that's when it started getting cold. And in a couple of months, it was December, and then he had realized knowledge. In America, it snows, and it gets like that, because he was in New York.
Especially in New York, yeah.
He was in New York, where the snow gets that deep in winter. So one is theoretical, and one is factual. So, to such a man who has controlled his mind, one who has conquered his mind, it means that he's now in touch with his soul, and he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, honor and dishonor are all the same. Otherwise, there's no tranquility. Our Srila Prabhupada stated in one ceremony in honor of his spiritual master's birthday, about 80 years ago, which was this body. Okay, now listen very carefully. I'm going to say it slowly. It's very poetic, but it's also truth. This body is just like a poison shirt, which is meant for the death of the wearer, the soul, who is never meant for wearing the shirt. We came here against the advice of the Lord that don't go there, you'll be miserable. But we wanted to do it anyway. So the body is just like a poison shirt, which is meant for the death of the wearer, that's never meant for wearing the shirt. The soul is meant to be free from the fetters and limitations of matter. And another one is the body is just like a cage, which is meant for the undoing of the bird. Not that the bird is meant for the upkeep of the cage. Did I say that again? Mm-hmm. The cage is meant, the body is just like a cage, which is meant for the undoing of the bird. That means he doesn't let the bird do what it wants to do. The undoing. He's just cramped there. The undoing of the bird, who is never meant, no, that's the other one, who is not, wait, body is the cage that is meant for the undoing of the bird, not that the bird is meant for the upkeep of the cage. The bird is not meant for the upkeep of the cage. Okay. So, it begins with Gyan, and then, under the guidance of Krishna's realized representative, who is situated in Big Gyan, or realized knowledge, who Krishna sends, or God sends, from the kingdom of God to this world to represent him and teach us these things, then under his guidance, gradually we follow a certain process which transforms theoretical knowledge into practical or realized knowledge. It's not that our endeavors transform it, but by pleasing that representative of God, he blesses us with realized knowledge. Just like a millionaire, let's say there's a multimillionaire, and you want to please the multimillionaire. What can you get the multimillionaire? Get him a house?
He has everything.
Yeah.
Just a friendship.
And what's a good way to get the friendship? Milambri?
isn't it that the millionaire also has a son, and that since the millionaire has everything, you can't give him anything. The way to please the millionaire is to give something simple like a lollipop to his son.
To give a lollipop to his son, and his son is happy, then the man is so happy. Or love me, love my dog.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God! Love me, love my dog.
Okay. So for that person, honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress is all the same, because he sees it all as a dream covering, which has nothing to do with his real self. It begins with Gyan. I keep telling myself. And then, even if I tell myself like a parrot, of course, ultimately, if we want advancement, we can't be like the parrot of just, it goes in one ear, out the other, and in the meantime, when it's passing from one ear out to the other, I'm just repeating it like a parrot without trying to take it in. Therefore, as a practice, I'll repeat the reality to myself. As a practice, I pray, and these songs are all authorized prayers, especially the Hare Krishna mantra is the most authorized. I pray that let this, through the songs and through the mantra, I pray let this theoretical knowledge, or make this theoretical knowledge into real. Let me realize my soul and my relationship with you, the Supreme Soul. So, regarding taking it in one ear and out the other, and not taking the time to repeat it and repeat it all the time and remember it and repeat it and pray that it becomes real. There's one instance in history where there was a very powerful king named Vikramaditya, and he had 9 counselors in his court, 9 very jewel-like, very smart advisors in his court council. So one day, a naked man, like a wild man with like wild dreadlocks and naked and looking intoxicated, wild, he came in to the court carrying a skull under his arm. A skull under his arm. And then he walked into the court and he put the skull on the table and he said, I want to know, was this man intelligent or foolish? So the advisors, all the jewel-like advisors were there, and all they could say was, how can you tell just by looking at a skull if the man was intelligent or foolish? It's not even a bona fide question. So the man said, he took back his skull, put it under his arms, and he said, I see this, I thought this was a place of scholars, now I see it's a place of fools. So then the king said, Vikramaditya said, but wait a minute, wait, I have one best of the jewels, Kalidas. He's my best scholar and advisor. Just wait a moment, he's coming. So then Kalidas came, and the mad-like naked person asked the same question. And Kalidas took one stick of a broom, you know, a broomstick, the skinny things. He took one and he stuck it in the ear. You know,
straw.
Yeah, like a big straw. And you know, there was no really ears on its skull. It's just holes. So he stuck it in one of the holes of the ear and it came out the other side. And he said, this man was a fool. So the madman said, oh, how did you know? He said, because it went in one ear and out the other. It was straight. If he was intelligent, the straw would have bent and it would have gone down his neck into his what would have been his heart. So on our own, we have no power because we're lost since the beginning of time, whirling around in various species of life. We don't have the power to take things in our heart. We can only do the gyan, do the process of getting out, that is chanting Hare Krishna, singing the songs, taking foodstuffs that are first offered to the Lord, not criticizing anyone, following in the instructions of a bona fide spiritual master and the process, and at the same time pray that it becomes a reality. And then when guru and devotees are pleased by my attempt, then they bless. Krishna himself, God himself, was personally, like here, this book is personally spoken by God to a very advanced devotee named Arjuna, and then that conversation is recorded. There's another recorded conversation where Krishna is speaking to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is the first living being in the universe. And he was instructing Lord Brahma that before creation, only I existed. Whatever you're seeing now during creation is only me. If you see anything that seems like it's not me, like it's something else, then know that this is only a product of the illusory energy, just like the shadow reflection in the darkness. It has no substance. A shadow reflection in the darkness. No substance. But it seems like it has substance if we're not intelligent. Just like the reflection of a tree in a muddy river. Seems like there's really a tree in the muddy river and we go to get it, but it's just muddy water. We go to get that flower, it's just muddy water. Go to get that fruit, it's just muddy water. No substance. So when mercy comes, by seeing the endeavor, the bona fide endeavor, then that becomes real. So Krishna said to Brahma, so I've told you that before creation there was only me, then what you're seeing now is only me, and after creation only I will remain. But you haven't realized anything I said. So now, then he placed his hand on his head and he said, now by my mercy you will realize everything. And then Brahma became a realized soul, and he's the first person in our disciplic succession. Well, I'll go on. A person is said to be established in self-realization and is called a yogi or a mystic when he is fully satisfied by virtue of acquired knowledge, that is gyan, theoretical knowledge, and realization, that is vigyan, or experienced knowledge. Such a person is situated in transcendence and is self-controlled. He sees everything, whether it be pebbles or stone or gold, as the same. Now, if I see a pebble or a stone or a gold, I don't see it as the same. So I'm not a yogi. In other words, I would like to get the gold. So the person who's in the practice, he at least tells himself that. And he prays that this can become a reality. And in that regard, I'm going to take a 1 minute intermission for a commercial again. Since I mentioned that about a person, I didn't mention it, Krishna mentioned it, about the person who's situated in transcendence and is self-controlled. Now, such a person in this world is very, very rare. But that very rare person is going to be in California in just
a week.
A week, wow. A week. On the 10th of June in San Diego. And much closer on the 12th of June in Los Angeles. And then on, from the 13th to the 20th in Badger. And if you are willing to come, we can arrange a ride for you. And then from the 20th to the 23rd in San Francisco. And by that time, you won't have a ride anyway. So we'll ride you to San Francisco. You're in Badger for a week. And then you can meet this kind of person that Krishna himself is telling us to connect with. And you can the devotees will tell you about it after. Then, now that's pretty advanced already. If you can see a pebble, stone, or gold is the same. But then, Krishna says, one is considered to be still further advanced when he regards all, the honest well-wisher, the friend, the enemy, the mediator, the envious, the pious, and the sinner, all with an equal mind, and also those who are indifferent and impartial. He sees them all with an equal mind. He has no friends and no enemies. One perfect example is Maharaj Ambarish. He was trying to be killed by this powerful yogi, not a spiritual yogi like this.
He was trying to be killed?
Well, somebody attempted to, the yogi tried to kill him.
Oh, somebody was trying to kill him. Oh, it sounds like he wanted to be killed.
Yeah, it sounds like.
Yeah. And that person was so powerful that he took a hair from his head, threw it on the floor, and out came this giant fire demon who raced towards King Ambarish. But King Ambarish was just had his hands folded, tears coming from his eyes, not out of fear, but because he was thinking of the Lord's pastimes. So the Lord sent a very powerful weapon called the chakra, which is the weapon he uses at the time of dissolution of the universe. And that weapon chased this yogi all over the universe, to the heavens, and then even to God's abode himself within the universe. And he was begging that, please save me. And so the Lord himself told him, if you want to be saved, you'll have to go and beg mercy from the person you tried to kill. So he went back through the universe and fell at the feet of King Ambarish and begged relief from the fiery chakra. So this whole thing took a year. And it turned out that Maharaj Ambarish all this time had been thinking, oh, due to me, due to offense that I committed, he didn't commit any offense, this yogi is now put into so much distress. So he was trying to pray to that weapon, to please not kill him. And then when that yogi fell at his feet and he begged to be saved, what did Maharaj Ambarish say? He said, well, you tried to kill me, don't expect anything from me. No, it wasn't a tit for tat for him. Rather, he said, oh yes, immediately, take all the results of my pious activities, at once be delivered. And then that powerful yogi realized what a great soul this was, and he surrendered to him, and he also became a devotee. So this is one who's said to be still further advanced. A transcendentalist should always try to concentrate his mind on the Supreme Self, like we are self, soul. And then there's a Supreme Soul, Eko Bohushama, that one Supreme Soul who manifested infinite souls to have loving relationships with them. Just imagine, I know you can't do this, but try and imagine not existing. Can you imagine that?
I used to lie in bed at camp when I was a kid and try and conceive of that, and I could not. And then when I read Bhagavad Gita, and I read the second chapter where Krishna says, you know, never was there a time when you did not exist, nor me, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. And I thought, yes, you know, I am eternal. And that's why I could never imagine not existing.
And we would have had no existence except for that he manifested us or created us from his own being. So always try to concentrate your mind on the Supreme Self. Live alone in a secluded place. Secluded doesn't mean go out of the city and go into the forest. It means live secluded from those who will create obstacles. Even if you're forced to live in a house where everybody's against what you're doing, then go into a secluded room or a secluded backyard. I'd like to call on Krishna Bhamani to speak for a few minutes. Well, I'll speak for a couple of minutes till she finds the Giwiks.
Oh, all right. I'll say
go ahead.
Just talking about the
realize knowledge as opposed to theoretical. So it's explained like somebody can describe to you what honey tastes like. You know, it's golden and it's thick and it's moist and it's sweet. But if you have no experience of honey, you know, it sounds interesting, but you still have no idea unless you taste it. So it's the same with this chanting. The chanting is the taste that we get that makes all the theoretical knowledge become close to us. It becomes more realized, yes. So, you know, that's why we always chant before we give talk, so that the chanting raises the consciousness above our material conditioning of our mind and our senses. It just lifts us up to another reality. And it makes us receptive to spirituality, spiritual topics, which we're not used to normally. So the chanting is so sweet. It's like honey, and it is called the Maha Mantra. And Maha means great. And Man means mind. And Tra means to free the mind. So the Maha Mantra is the great chant for freeing the mind from all of the material designations, so we can begin to understand our real nature and our real identity. And Lord Chaitanya came in this age just 500 years ago. He was most recent, Krishna coming in the most recent time, just 500 years ago in India. And he spread this chanting of Hare Krishna around because he said, in this age that we live, our lives are very short and our senses are very distracted and our memories are very imperfect. So it's very difficult for us to perform austerities, as Krishna describes in the sixth chapter. When Arjuna, Krishna's disciple, heard all the different things that Krishna was describing, that to go to the forest and to meditate, and he said, I cannot do this. If one of the senses is distracted, Krishna says it just carries away the whole intelligence of the person trying to control them. You can see, you know, just one little sense goes astray and you follow it. So this chanting is recommended in this age that we live, this age of Kali Yuga, meaning the age of quarrel and confusion, that it's so simple and so sublime, and even the child can benefit. It's free. All the animals can benefit, everybody. So that's why we chant, so people can hear and the living entities in the air can hear.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's getting late.
So anyway, we can chant a little bit, and then we'll take this wonderful foodstuff that's been offered to Krishna. And
tomorrow we'll continue with this chapter. We're having a program tomorrow night?
I don't know.
Real quick question, though. See, because we're dealing with the chapter on yoga. So many people think yoga is different. I know we'll continue, but positions, breathing, those different names.
I wanted to say that. But yeah. This is bhakti yoga.
Right.
What we do, bhakti yoga, and bhakti means love. So this is the yoga of devotion. There's the eightfold process of mystic yoga, but the culmination is to link up with our beloved, Radha Krishna, and this is the process. So it's the yoga of devotion. We're trying to connect personally, just like in this world, we connect personally, and that's what makes life satisfying. If we have loving relationships with parents and loved ones and friends and teachers, but all these relationships do end; they're temporary because we all have these bodies. So we're trying to connect with Krishna on an eternal level,
and with each other on an eternal level through bhakti yoga.
Yeah. Hatha yoga is beneficial in so much as it allows you to, say, sit for a more extended period of time or to calm the mind down to, after, you know, a hard day's work. It can, like, what is the saying, like, a good dog is a tired dog because they can't run around and, you know, destroy the house. At least me, after I do, like, a yoga workout, I'm tired, so I'm more calm. So by default, I can focus better on japa.
Preventive maintenance for the vehicle.
Yeah, there you go.
But in the chapter...
Wear me out.
In the chapter we're reading, does Krishna... I mean, is our other... I mean, the main form of yoga would be the chanting and the bhakti, the love of God. And that's a form of yoga. But are other forms of yoga even recommended?
Well,
karma yoga.
If everybody will come back tomorrow night, that's a whole class for the answer.
Okay.
Any other questions? She covered so much.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I wanted to say, this is Shamarani, and she is the most talented artist. She has done these beautiful paintings of Krishna. And, you know, there's no better way for us to get an idea of the spiritual world and how beautiful it all is than the descriptions in the books, and then having somebody like Shamarani, who's so talented, and through the guidance of our spiritual master directing her of the descriptions. She's done, these are all original art paintings.
And these really are only a few. There have been done, I want to say that she's been doing it for years. They're in many books. They're in temple walls over India. And,
she's been painting for over 50 years.
Not
40.
38.
These are by 70 years.
Yeah,
38. By direction of her guru. And her gurus, you know, and unbelievable. And to see, to come into some of the temples in India and see some of the work, and unbelievable.
In the other room, actually, we were fortunate to be able to, there's a few that have been put into some poster. Very beautiful, if anybody is interested.
And just a night ago or so, we had an hour and a half, just a lecture on this one. Just what's going on. Some people will see, oh, there's this and this, but there's much meaning, and these are all in the scriptures. Each of these paintings are described in specific scriptures. So interesting.
And in our next program, then, besides finishing this chapter, we'll also have a discussion on this one, because this is the only one we didn't talk about.
Right.
Okay.
Shula Gurudev Ki Jai, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Lord Premanandi, Hari Hari.
Sorry, I couldn't get a door. I think it might have broken. It's a speaker. I think it might. It's very lightweight. I think it might be broken.
Out.
You get laryngitis tomorrow.
So what are we doing now? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare.